you really need to get outsized value for your investors and outsized return. And so that's just being super, super selective. Look, we've done projects where we've performed way better than we thought possible, and we've done some that haven't performed as well. And if I look at those ones where we didn't perform as well, it's because we weren't selective enough.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that we interview key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we'll be speaking with Stephen Wendell. Stephen is an experienced investor and developer across a wide range of asset classes. On today's podcast, we discuss his journey into real estate, the evolving state of hospitality, strategies to identify gaps in the marketplace, and the power of creating unique experiences and brands. It's well worth a listen.
Hey, Stephen, thanks for hopping on the podcast.
Hey, Gordon, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So I wanted to ask you first, why real estate? Because, you know, you look at your background, you've got law, it looks like you worked for the Eagles at one point.
Yeah.
Why real estate?
Yeah. So I think it's really, I do have a natural inclination to it, but I don't think I would if it wasn't for my father kind of being in that industry growing up. He, from when I was born, he's CPA and was doing some stuff before I was born, but he was firmly into the real estate world by the time I was born in 1983. So he opened his first hotel the month I was born. So I was kind of like around it from zero. And so I was always intrigued by it. And then, you know, went to law school and came out during the recession, the global financial crisis. So instead of going to the firm directly in New York to Proskauer, they kind of sent us to clients for a year to kind of, you know, pay us a little less, but keep us around the rim until we could come to the firm when business had picked up. And they're a huge sports law firm. So I got to work for the Philadelphia Eagles for a year. Now I'm a lifelong Birds fan. And when I was living there, I just kind of got intrigued with the city and trying to understand like why there were gaps in the road, you know, very close to Center City. And I think that real estate bug kind of was there, and I had enough time to kind of explore. You know, I was getting paid by a firm and not by the Eagles, so it wasn't the hardest job in the world. And so that we did a couple of deals, one in particular that kind of started off, and then that got the bug going. And, you know, I said, Dad, after a year at the law firm, I was like, let's go do real estate full time. Let's do some more non-hotel stuff. And then on the hotel side, let's take your strong relationships with the brands and let's build in some more kind of urban environments and college towns in the Southeast. And that was kind of 2011. And here we are, you know, almost 15 years later, still doing it. You know, thesis has changed probably a little bit, but, you know, that's it.
So I'm definitely going to try to get back to your thesis and try to understand a little bit more about how you perceive the market and how you think there are those gaps in the market.
Yeah.
What we really wanted to talk about early in the podcast is seeing those gaps. So what led you to believe that there were gaps in the Philadelphia market beyond just empty spots? And how do you see those gaps kind of elsewhere?
Yeah, great question. So Philly in particular is a really interesting city if you haven't lived there. And then living there, you see it very, very differently. And I don't want to claim to be a Philadelphian. I don't want them coming out on this podcast and getting angry at me. It's an adopted city for me, but, you know, Center City is such a tight, you know, area when you compare it to other urban centers. And the zoning in Center City, Philadelphia nothing is ever by right. So getting through the rezoning process, extremely difficult. You have to have a lot of time and patience and know the right people on the ground. And so for that reason, a ton of, you know, what would you say, traditional multifamily, traditional nationwide office developers won't enter that market as a developer because it's just too much time, too much risk. They'd rather just come in and buy the existing asset. So there's, you know, and the cap rates don't, you know, they're a little higher there than obviously DC or New York, but there is a real spread in being able to get a project actually done there. And so that is what I learned early on a very small project. And we got very lucky to kind of meet a property management brokerage firm in OCF Realty that really understands the city really well. And so we've been able to do almost over 10 projects over the last decade there. And we're actually building right now, 3-4 months from finishing, 247 apartments on top of commercial space that are leased to CVS and Aldi. And that's on Washington Avenue, which is the kind of new southern boundary corridor of the city. You know, and I think a lot of people forget, it's like the fifth or sixth largest city in the country. It gets often overlooked by New York and DC. There's nowhere near as much development of those two cities. So we view it as kind of this underdog city. I know a lot of the residents view it that way too, which is why they're so passionate about their sports teams. And so that was that city in general. And then I'd say globally, or not globally, but, you know, other markets, you know, we can identify where I think hotels, you know, obviously we do Mountain Shore, we do hotels and non-hotels. On the hotel side, it's a little easier to kind of soft circle a city that you think is really on the rise, i.e. Nashville in 2014. It was like, okay, this is going to go really good. And then it's like, where do we go? Which neighborhood do we want to put it in? And that's kind of the MO there. I think you really need to understand a city almost from a living standpoint to know where to put residents, office. So the amount of cities where we'll do hotels is much bigger than the amount of hotel cities where we will do non-hotels. I have to have lived there. One of us has lived there. So Charleston, South Carolina, where I'm from, where I am right now, we will do anything because I know it very, very well. And you can pick the sub pocket or the sub neighborhood where a certain asset class should go.
I'd love to dive into that in terms of understanding sub neighborhoods and sub pockets. But one of the things that we wanted to kind of go in is, and I know you mentioned it, that there's a big disparity between the difference of the hospitality world versus some other asset classes. So what's the state of hospitality right now? I'm an office industrial expert, but one of the things we find fascinating about hospitality is it's very service driven versus like our industry, which should be more service driven. A lot of our guests find a tremendous value in that asset class. What are you seeing in hospitality in 2020?
And it is crazy right now, in my opinion, because, and I'll try not to get too long-winded, but, you know, when I got in 2011, I really knew nothing other than what I had gathered through osmosis through my father. And, you know, this is a guy that did the 13th Hampton Inn in the country in the mid-80s. Now there's 3,000. So traditional select service box, which, you know, Hilton got very, they did it right. And it still survives today and it thrives today, the Hampton Inn box. But you got to remember when, like, the whole like franchising model and like hotels going everywhere, it's one generation old, you know, and if you go look at the 80s and the 90s, it started, people were building them, but not like the rapid pace that we have now. And so now we've got, you know, five major companies, huge value companies in Accor, Hyatt, IHG, Marriott, and Hilton that are proliferate. I mean, like the amount of hotels that they're putting out via franchise model is incredible. And there's, in my opinion, too many flags. There's too much sameness. And but there's this, you know, desire for shareholder value to go up. Well, the only way it goes up is through fees and through growth. So they need more hotels. And if you've already put a Hampton Inn in every single city in the United States, well, we got to do something that's a little different than a Hampton Inn, but it's also going to take market share. And so I understand that. And there is different concepts, extended stay versus select, up and down the scale that serve different customer bases. But you have to understand the fundamental difference here that, you know, if one hotel is getting $6 million in revenue, and a second hotel comes, and that first hotel now gets 4.5 or 5, but the other hotel also gets 3.5 or 4. You know, as long as those two hotels are still profitable and can pay Hilton or Marriott, the franchisor is in a better shape, but not necessarily that first hotel guy. So when you're picking places to develop, first you have to know that you're going into a good location, because otherwise, why would you do it? But if you're going into a good location, people are going to develop on top of you, and you need to build something that really survives the test of time and can, you know, support a 20-year mortgage or 25-year mortgage, whatever you're putting on it. And, you know, sometimes that is a Hampton Inn, and it'll work. We have a Marriott Courtyard in Charleston, West Virginia, the capital, that still is the newest hotel that was built in that sub-downtown market since 2016. Well, great. That doesn't need some fancy boutique hotel to you know, maybe long last. So each sub-pocket, each market is different in what I think is the proper thing to build. And we are in a time now where the value of the franchise might not necessarily go 20 years, but man, they got all of the brand power and the loyalty and the customers. So doing it without them is really, really tough. So I think the brands are all in really good positions. But as a franchisee, you need to be selective, smart. You can't just go do something. You can go do something just because, but to actually go and take on the risk of developing the hotel asset versus just buying stock in those five companies, you really need to get outsized value for your investors and outsized return. And so that's just being super, super selective. Look, we've done projects where we've performed way better than we thought possible, and we've done some that haven't performed as well. And if I look at those ones where we didn't perform as well, it's because we weren't selective enough.
Can you tell me about a time when you were selective and found kind of a niche and maybe like a moderately saturated market? So I think most of our investors that listen to the podcast are in saturated markets, and it's New York, LA, Los Angeles, even, you know, Chicago, Dallas, Philadelphia, Miami. And so they're sitting there and they're saying, how do you niche down and find that sub-market that you can find it, or that asset class that maybe just one block further? So can you tell me about a time when
you... Yeah, I can tell you a couple times, you know, and you know, one of the reasons we love these Southeast markets, other than where we're from them, a lot of people moving there, they largely underdeveloped, and you can kind of understand where the trend's going. I mean, Charlottesville, Virginia is a great example of one, kind of the first deal I was involved in when I came over to the company. And, you know, not a city, you know, that everybody knows about. Obviously, University of Virginia is there, which is one of the reasons we know about it. My dad actually kind of started his working life and his marriage working there. And then I went to law school there. And so we kind of have that tie. And I was in law school and I was like, Dad, you know, you got to build a hotel here. There's not enough. And there's so many people like this is a great spot. But then we said, well, you know, you could go out to the main thoroughfare and just the land went for days. And, you know, the connector between Charlottesville and DC, and you just plop one. Right. And, you know, OK, that would be all right. I was like, no, you got to be walkable to the university and downtown. And so then it's Main Street, which is kind of a mile from downtown to the university. But then you start talking barriers to entry, architectural review board, all the stuff. But we found a property on the corner and it was great. And it had all kinds of really hard restrictions, and it took 2 years to get it through the review board. But we got it there, and we built this Residence Inn, which, you know, we've sold to Noble, the REIT out of Atlanta. But that is a great example. And that thing is still humming. It was hard for us to sell it. But, you know, it's now, you know, when did we open that? 16, 17. I mean, that's probably 9 years old. And it's still just crushing. And that's location, location, location. Another example in Tallahassee, Florida, you know, there's the university and the capital. They're separated by this, you know, land that's mile-ish long. And for the longest time, it was not developed, just the Capitol or just the university. And then as it's starting to get developed, all the student housing has been built. There's restaurants and stuff going on. And now it's like, wow, this is where a hotel could go. before it was not a nice enough area. Now it's great, and you can pull from both the university and from the Capitol. And so we do a Hampton Inn there. We actually did a Hampton Inn and a Hyatt House separated by a couple of years. And that Hampton just like out of the gates, just skyrocketing, just unbelievable performance. And so those are areas where oftentimes the locals, the local developers won't have done it yet because it's not top of mind to them. And it's really hard sometimes as a local, I can say that being in Charleston, it's sometimes hard to view your city almost as it is because you've been in it so much and you're used to your own bias. It's really hard to see it that way. And, you know, I think a lot of the opportunity from people not from Nashville has been there because it's like, how could you see it moving as fast as it was when you're there? You just, your bias is that no, like we can't have all of SoBro be completely developed. And, you know, it's just, there's no way to predict it when you live there almost.
Yeah. A fish doesn't always realize they're swimming in water. Right. So,
Absolutely. The advantage we get from, I'd say that's one of our advantages from developing in different cities versus just one city.
So in terms of your strategy, you've mentioned college towns a couple of different times already. So why do you focus on college towns in particular versus, you know, other assets or other metro areas, I should say?
Yeah. You know, it was a simple thesis to start that came. Yeah, hotels are about demand generators, and this demand generators aren't going anywhere. Now, you talk about something that's changed over 10 years. Certain colleges are going nowhere. Certain other colleges are going somewhere, and they're going to cease to exist possibly, or they'll be swallowed by some of the big ones. But, you know, we love that as the recurring, and it wasn't just, you know, two times a year, three times a year. It's all year long. Take a place like Tallahassee and Charlottesville. They've got huge sports presence. Tallahassee is a bonus. Nashville is a bonus because they are also the capital city. And so when you have this multitude of demand generators that really aren't going anywhere, i.e. the capital and the university, that is just such a baseline comfort that, you know, you're going to have a smoothness of business, which then gives you an ability to kind of know what your downside is, but also as a rate management tool, like, you know, you're going to have not only constant bookings, but bookings very far in the future because of large events like game days and like, you know, legislative session. And that then gives you the power to price properly. And it's just, it all feeds into it. And we've just found that they are really catalysts. And then, now you look at it, okay, what if we're doing a boutique in a college town? How do we kind of get the town also wrapped in, the locals wrapped into wanting to come there? And you know, the boutiques that we've done over the last 4 years are very new for us. And so that's a whole different transition for the hotel aspect of the company. But a lot of the same tenements are there.
Oh, I know I'm going to get back to the boutiques, but I'm curious, you mentioned college towns that are disappearing. And certainly enrollment's down. What are you seeing in terms of that? Because there are a lot of people that might be interested in investing in college towns. What do you see as maybe not the best strategy for entering a town? And what's kind of a town that might be, you know,
potentially... I'm trying to think of one that has like a small, like kind of, you know, a lot of the towns that we're looking at are big time college towns. Like we're getting ready to do a project in Madison, Wisconsin, 50,000 students. So if I was doing a kind of apartment project in a town where a small college was, and I was just banking on student, you know, that is where, and enrollment was declining. That is where I would get very kind of nervous, because some of these, you know, colleges, and I can't remember the one in Philadelphia, is art college that just like suddenly closed. And so if I was like, well, I've got a building there, these students are going to be there the whole time, I would really want to make sure it was a big university, because not only are the finance is tough, but you know, the value of the 4-year education, if you know, you don't go to one of the top 50 schools, is now really in question and starting, you know, to be questioned, which it should be, because you're, you know, not guaranteed of some 6-figure job. and you're also losing 4 years of the workforce that you could be in. So it better pay, you know?
Well, in terms of like losing time, which it certainly, that's a worry for a lot of folks and why we're seeing decline in admission. One of the things that people lose time in is searching, and I just feel like they aimlessly search. So beyond colleges, what's your search criteria when you're looking for a site location? I know you mentioned walkability in Charleston. Is walkability a big feature when you're looking at a program? Because it's kind of hard to find in the South in some spots.
Yeah, it is. It really is. For hotels specifically, the best example is Louisville that I can give you right off the top of my head because we just did it. You know, that's a town where it's like, okay, I understand this city and the core city, but then there's this new up and coming neighborhood. And I feel like every city that is growing from a population standpoint has an up and coming neighborhood. And I'm not just saying, let's go to the token up and coming neighborhood. And that's what we do. And that's all we do. Louisville was a great example of like, okay, we've got a really vibrant city that has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on their new convention center. And then a mile from Center City, Louisville, is this new neighborhood called Nulu that has all these historic buildings that restaurants have moved to, that shops have moved to. And it's just like, okay, this is where it's going. And that's an easy one where, having been in Nashville, you look at a city like that and you understand that, okay, well, I'm not going to say it's going to be Nashville. I don't know if there will be another Nashville the way that it is gone. But if you look at a city like Louisville and you know that that neighborhood is just only going to get better. So if your basis is good, you know you're going to build upwards. And I'd rather be a little too early to a neighborhood than too late all the time. As long as I feel like that neighborhood's coming, even if it takes several years for it to come, I can ride that wave up. If you spend too much in your basis on a neighborhood that's kind of already peaked, you know, yeah, you might not go bankrupt and lose all your, you're not going to, you know, maybe not cover your debt, but you might lose money.
Yeah. So when you're looking at an early neighborhood entry, are you primarily going and investing in building the project, even like somewhat spec, or are you sitting on land? How do you guys usually look at early neighborhood entry?
Both, right? And I think we've been doing real estate forever, and now we have a real estate fund, which we started in 2021, which one of the advantages of that is that we can do both, right? Okay, we're ready. We bought it. Let's go ahead and build. It's ready. But in another couple instances, like Chattanooga, we own a piece of land and we've owned it now for a bit. And it's just south side of Chattanooga. It's there, but it's the rate of the ADRs of the hotels is not quite where I'd want to see it. And so no big deal. We'll hold the land and we'll wait. And that is, you know, if you buy a piece of land in an area that is growing, as long as it's not crazy to carry it, which often it's not, because it's in a growing area that doesn't have as crazy real estate taxes, insurance, all this stuff, you can wait and then develop it properly. And then worst case, you say, you know what? I don't, whatever. There's other opportunities. Let's just sell the land and there'll be someone else to buy it that does want to take that risk and look at it differently. So we are doing both. Louisville, we bought and went real quick. Charleston, Chattanooga, we have a property in North Charleston that we probably will move on next. In Chattanooga, we're going to wait probably still another year before we do anything.
So I know you mentioned brands earlier, and I think branding is one of the most under-talked about parts of the real estate industry. I'm curious, what do guests look for in a brand? Because
I know
in hospitality that's crucial. What are you seeing in the market versus, you know, what you saw maybe even 5 or 10 years ago?
Yeah, for sure. Great question. So if it is hard branded, Hampton Inn, Marriott Courtyard, they're looking for sameness and repeatability. And, you know, there's a reason that the legacy, the longest lasting ones like Hampton have continued to succeed, even with all of these other things that other brands that have come about. It's because every customer really knows what they're going to get out of Hampton Inn, and they know what they're paying for. And Hilton's brand standards are pretty sound. And yes, they changed them over time to deal with mobile check-in and all of that kind of stuff. But man, they know what they're going to get. They know what they're going to pay for. And that business traveler that's going for one night, you know, they can pick from what they like. When you go to the boutiques, man, you need individuality. You need to be unique. You need to not only make the guests feel like they're in someplace special, but you need the locals that live around it to feel like they're around something special. And it can't just be a token name or a token something. And I think, you know, people that aren't in the industry, you start talking to them about branding. And even before I started doing boutiques, or we started doing boutiques, I didn't understand the value of it. I didn't understand the value of interior design. And I didn't understand the value of any of that the way that I do now, and how small decisions that you make, sometimes ones that you make in a phone call on a weekly phone call, it takes 5 minutes to make it. And then it has this huge impact. I mean, you take Louisville, one of our early design calls, we went from square windows, rectangular windows on the top to arch. And it's a new building, and all the old buildings have arched windows on the top. So we kind of wanted to pay homage to them. And I can't tell you how many people have been like, man, we love those windows on the top. It's such a great thing. It makes it look like the building has been here for a long time. And, you know, and just as easily we could have not thought of that. And I know that's a little different than branding, but that's the identity of the hotel. No. And it's incredibly important.
No, for sure. I mean, beyond just the architect, how do you create that feeling of special? Because design can be a great way to do that. But are there ways outside of architectural design that you give that boutique and that specialty feeling?
Oh, yeah. I mean, with architectural design, interior design, and all branding, but then the culture of the people that you hire and, you know, trying to hire locally and getting those people to work and share the same mission of providing, you know, great guest service and making the guests feel, you know, super welcome and that it is a special experience. I mean, I, you know, have recently read Will Goddard's book, Unreasonable Hospitality, which I would recommend anybody in the service industry to read. It's, you know, no secret at this point what they have been able to accomplish, or he's been able to accomplish with his team at 11 Madison Park, but it's such a good read for the little things. And we're now in a world where certain things are just a given. We'll check in. Like there's things that just everyone has to provide. It's table stakes. And so, and they're becoming more automated and more mandated. And so how do you differentiate yourself? It often comes down to the little things. And it's like, well, gosh, those are just little things. And it's like, yeah, but they're big things to certain people. And if you do one little thing for two guests each day, well, that's, you know, 800 guests at the end of the year that you've impacted who are then going out in the world and talking about your place. And so it's really that, you know, they say hospitality is a 24/7, 365 business, and it really is.
Can you give me an example of like a little thing that maybe might do for guests?
Yeah, if you have a VIP coming in, you know, we've got folks in Louisville coming in from bourbon brands all over the world and making sure that little bottle is there in their room with a personal note, it is something that, you know, they see and they read. And, or if you have a VIP coming in for our property in upstate New York, we have, you know, big people people celebrating weddings, events, and really making, you know, that as special as it can be for them, and taking the time to ask them, hey, what's your, you know, favorite XYZ thing, and going out and procuring it for them and having it in the room, as opposed to just putting a random bottle of XYZ and you don't even know if they drink wine, you know, like that doesn't, it's like, it's nice. The worst thing ever is that little token gift that's still sitting there when the person's done, like, hey, thank you, but I didn't even really want it. And it's like, well, you could have done something that, and that was an $80 bottle of wine. All right, we stock it back and whatever. And it's like, well, you could have done something that, and that was an $80 bottle of wine. All right, we stock it back and whatever. But there could have been something that was cost $10 that they would have just loved if you took the time to ask the question. And look, the bigger the property, the harder it is to do that. You can't do it for everybody. In Louisville, we have this booklet that everybody gets when they get in that tells the story of the hotel, the branding, the city, and gives little factoids about that. It's like a little guide. And so that's a great example of something we thought of in the beginning. We're doing a project, and I'm originally from West Virginia, and we're building a hotel there. And I'm kind of naming the restaurant after my grandmother, and she had this like famous Chex Mix. And so we're going to remake it, and it's going to be like in everybody's room when they get there. So those are the things that you kind of like imagine, and then you execute, and then you see how people react to them. It's awesome.
So one of the things I think you've done that's pretty awesome as well is you've gone kind of a little bit outside of your asset class that you started in, which was hospitality.
Yep.
And I'm curious if you've taken some of these strategic site location techniques and tools and strategies, as well as kind of that hospitality touch, to other industries. I know you've been involved in some office, I think a couple other projects as well.
For sure. Right. Yeah, 100%. I mean, we're building an apartment building now, and just even thinking about the common area and like how you can make that more special and not just do it some token, apartment building common area. But great example of that is an office building in Charleston that we're involved in. It's on the upper part of the peninsula, which is, historically not been developed. And we joint ventured with a guy here that had already bought an old Standard Oil site that, had been contaminated. It had three small buildings that he had turned into kind of creative office. And his vision was to build a new three-story structure and a huge outdoor amphitheater, which would be Charleston Peninsula's only outdoor music venue. And it's like near this rail line. I mean, it's a whole thing. And the bottom floor of that office building would have F&B component. So top two floors are office, some of the ground floor else on facing the street is. And so now we had this whole campus, which included restaurants, a brewery, a music venue, and creative office. And when I say creative office, I mean, people have to have a creative mind to be like, wait, I'm not just going into a regular office building. And so this plan was before COVID. So then COVID happens, and we are delivering this property a year into COVID, and we lease it up because it's the type of place that people still want to be in and be around, because there is this hospitality element to it. And like the default thinking is, wow, man, I don't want an amphitheater at my office site. And it's like, well, not everybody does, but we're not playing music at noon. We're playing music at, 7 o'clock on a Friday. And so now everybody is like really excited to be involved in this space. And we give them, free access to the concerts when they come, and there's VIP. And so there's that element of adding something to something that's traditional that then makes it better. And it's really at no cost. It's just thoughtfulness. And so that office building is 100% occupied. And so this traditional high rise sitting in Chicago that everyone's like, oh, it's not good. We're not experiencing that in Charleston. And I think that's been the story of kind of post COVID. We're in a world now where there's some stuff doing really, really well, and then there's some stuff doing not so well. And so the economy usually points one way, and everything kind of points generally in that direction. And what we're seeing right now is a lot of stuff pointing up and a lot of stuff pointing down, and we're trying to make heads or tails of it. All of us are.
Yeah, I think creative destruction is a general positive for the market, and things will sort themselves out. I think it's funny with your amphitheater comment, because as I'm sitting here, I could look out my window, and we have an amphitheater here in our office that is well leased as well, right?
But yeah, it's awesome.
It's about creating that experience that's a little bit different. I know, we're having food trucks today and a band and that are going on. And folks that are just trying to do, your standard class B office, they're going to get eaten alive. So in terms of trying to eat folks alive in the market and through process of creative destruction, I know we talked about identifying site selection. I know we talked about all sorts of factors in terms of what the customer's looking for. The last thing I'm curious about is when you look and you find a property, are you a land buyer primarily? Are you a buyer that's looking at trying to find sites that are currently existing and rehab them? What is it that you look at when you're ideally looking at a little?
Yeah, mostly land buying. We will do some rehabilitation. I mean, the Madison deal is a rehab of an old office building, but it was the original first skyscraper in Madison, Wisconsin. And that deal, the landowners are putting it into the deal. A lot of times what we end up doing or having to do, Louisville the same way. You know, we've built now 28 hotels. I think over half of them, the landowners have put the land in the deal or the building in the deal to do the deal. So oftentimes we're looking at stuff that's off market and have to get take a year for someone to trust you, which I understand. In today's world, trust is earned. It is a tough thing because we're just dealing in a different time now. And so that is often what we're looking for is land that is off market, but that's in the right area and that there's a deal. Sometimes the group wants to sell it and you got to negotiate the price. Sometimes they want to put it in the deal and then that takes a little bit longer. So I mean, it's worked for us. A lot of developers don't want, you know, new partners that aren't their existing partners. And we figured out a way to have that work for us. And when we develop in all these different cities, usually that partner, that land partner is local and they know the jurisdiction and they know what the bad things to do and the right things to do. So that's been extremely helpful to us and leaned on. And even if they're not in real estate, having a local partner, I think, gives you some legitimacy to the community, especially when you're talking about community. When you're developing, you don't live there, but your partner does. That helps a lot.
So I know you mentioned finding off-market opportunities. Do you primarily find those through local land partners? How is it that you find these off-market opportunities, particularly as an outside the community?
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things is we kind of concentrate ourselves like east of the Mississippi first. So it's like, okay, I'm not even looking. Like someone calls me about something in Bozeman, I get excited, but I'm like, I can't, I'm not going to look at it. So, and then you go east. Okay. Now we got 20 cities that really I need to deal with. And I will literally Louisville, I'll take a trip and I get a broker and, you know, 3 days and it's, hey, let's tour the market. Let's talk. Let's let you understand that I'm not here wasting your time, that if you bring me a good deal in off market or on market, and we do it. Well, and here are the other cities where I have done that and look at the stuff that we've built. And so sometimes you get a good broker and Louisville is a great example. We have a guy there named John Fisher that, I mean, has been more than a broker. He's been a friend and an ally to the property, and he's now an investor in the property. So amazing stuff there. But sometimes you get one that doesn't take you seriously for whatever reason, and it just kind of goes nowhere. And so that city kind of falls off. But that's really how, and you know, that's how, you know, Louisville happened, and that's how Tallahassee happened. And then those people, what happens is that the hotel is usually a beachhead where we do the deal. And then now I understand Louisville, or I understand Tallahassee, and I've done it and we've been in it long enough, and we took a building through zoning and through the permitting process. Oh, well, let's go do that apartment building over there. Well, let's go grab this building over here and let's do this, or let's partner with a, you know, other developer that we've met that's been impressed with what we've done to do something. And so that's happened probably more frequently than I thought it would happen. And that's been a kind of unexpected byproduct of how we've developed and how we continue to grow. It's very opportunistic. It's a small fund by fund standards. So there's not a huge mandate to go do, you know, $300 million worth of deals, you know, so we're slow and steady.
So I know we've been slowly, steady going along, but I think that beachhead idea in communities is an absolutely essential thing. We've seen in our area, we're Chicagoland based, so Illinois, Wisconsin, but as soon as you leave kind of your little niche of the world, if you're just dipping your toe in the water, it's best not to drop a couple $100 million and not know what you're doing. So,
I mean, absolutely.
In terms of going and kind of dipping our toe in the water, though, we'd like to do one last thing that we always do on the podcast, which is our final. Final four is kind of a nice little roundup where we get to learn a little bit more about you and learn kind of how you see the world. So the question we always ask is, where do you see the real estate or hospitality going over the next 10 years?
Yeah, I see. It's a really great question. And I do believe that this trend of lifestyle hotels, call them boutique, call them lifestyle, whatever you want to call them, is going to continue to proliferate. People want that experience when they're traveling. And I believe, and look, you've seen acquisitions all the time, you know, Hyatt's buying Standard and Bunkhouse, which I'm very much in tune with, Hilton bought Nomad, and on it's going to go. So the big boys are placing all their chips and their monopoly pieces. And I think the interesting thing to see will be which of the brands kind of die away, how quickly that happens, and what is the kind of after effect of that on franchisees and hotel developers. And there's going to be some, I think, winners and some real losers in this. And I think that's going to be the change. And then how does AI, how does automation technology play in the hospitality industry? How can we use it to our advantage, but not strip away hospitality? And I think if you read these books like Unreasonable Hospitality, you have to have the human element to make it special. And how do we, in a world where labor is tough and it's increasing in cost, how can we use the technology to our advantage, but still keep all that human element? And I think all that stuff is going to play out over the next 10 years.
So one of the human elements that we always like to talk about is kind of how we got here. And we have a lot of young brokers and developers that listen. I would say of the podcast, group, I'd say probably a quarter are probably brokers and developers under 30 that listen. And so in terms of that, one of the things that we always like to ask is, like, when you were starting out the business and you're working your first deal, what, would you tell yourself if you were looking?
Well, patience. This is not a quick moving business. Some days feel like moving faster than you could ever imagine because there's six things going wrong on six deals. But from a development standpoint, you have to understand that there's a long-term, return and vision. And I think also dealing with mistakes, and I don't mean your own mistakes, just collectively your own and everybody's in development, you're going to have 100 things go wrong no matter what you do. And so understanding that going in, I really did not have a good comprehension of that. And I would get very frustrated when things went wrong, and even small things. And now you really understand that development is about managing the risk and then managing when those things go wrong and making it not go so bad or not impact your deal so bad, and staying long-term oriented on what the thing is that you're trying to do.
So one of the ways we like to kind of stay long-term oriented is through education and educating ourselves about the market, about deal strategy, even about, the human condition. And I know you've already mentioned Unreasonable Hospitality, which is a great book, and we've suggested it on the podcast before. I'm curious, do you have another read that if someone's out there interested in learning more that they should pick up?
That one more is the hospitality kind of element of it. I think there's various real estate books out there, but the one thing that I come back to, I was fortunate enough to at Princeton take a class from Daniel Kahneman, which wrote Thinking Fast and Slow, but the class was called Behavioral Economics. And of course, he's the Nobel Prize winner for the very theory of behavioral economics, prosperity theory. And so you look at pinch me moments when you look back on it, and you certainly can't appreciate everything when you're 20 and 21 years old the way that you should. But as an economics major, where you're taught that 1 + 1 = 2 mostly, and then he's like, well, 1 + 1 doesn't always equal 2 in our minds. That really changed the way that I thought and thought about the kind of the world and the decisions that we were making, and about my own decisions and how I view risk and money. And therefore, if I'm viewing it irrationally sometimes, and I'm a pretty rational person, then how many other people are viewing it irrationally? And And it's just, it trickles through everything. Like the way that you raise money, the way that you put money out, the way that you take on risk, the way that the guest thinks about values A versus B, and depending on where they're coming from. And so that book and his kind of theories in general have made it easier for me to understand what is a very irrational world.
World is irrational, and hopefully we can at least rationally deal with it. In terms of that, the whole idea for the podcast is all about people, right? And dealing with people. And we firmly believe that when we're reaching out and going onto the market, men and women in the arena know who to reach out to best. And I know you mentioned John Fisher earlier on the podcast, but is there somebody else that, you know, we should be reaching out to in the world of real estate to learn a little bit more about what's going on and have on the podcast next?
Oh, you know, I could just say my partner, Ryan, but, you know, I don't know exactly who that is. I think there's really... So AI is coming and I don't understand it very much. I mean, I've used ChatGPT, but you know, I'm speaking of Bunkhouse, the former founder, Liz, is 3D printing a whole hotel in Marfa, Texas right now. So what is technology doing and it's moving so fast, and what are the real implications? And I would love to hear from someone that like actually can say, well, this is going to be here in 10 years. This is going to be here in 15. So gosh, if I'm putting a deal in the ground now that like is going to be obsolete for XYZ reason, or how can I, you know, how can I think about that and where that's changing? Or even you look at cars, are we going to go self-driving? Okay. Yeah, probably, especially on the highways. So are highway hotels just, why would I build them if I'm going from city to city? And so like, there's some real like, big things that haven't happened yet but are being talked about, and the inertia is that way, that if they were true today would have major impacts on existing assets and development. And I would love to hear someone who, you know, could synthesize all that, because it's really sometimes hard for my brain to even contemplate and think about.
Yeah, we definitely had several futurists on, and we're certainly looking at exploring that more. But there's one last thing we'd like to explore in the podcast before we finish up. And it's just, what's the best way for someone to reach out to you and get in contact?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's Steven@mountainshoreproperties.com. And you can also go onto the website and kind of through the contact form. But, you know, you can email me directly. We're looking, you know, always for new opportunities. And I'm a, you know, as a lawyer, so I'm an inbox zero guy. So I don't miss very many emails.
I wish I was. Sometimes the emails overwhelm me. Steven, thanks for hopping on the podcast, and we have to have you on in the future.
Hey, thank you very much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks again to Steven. We really appreciate his insights. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments and interactions and subscriptions truly matter, and they help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or pretty much wherever you can get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanfear with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.